Insurance companies have paid out what are known as structured settlements to the victims of lead paint poisoning for years, but instead of awarding six-figure one-lump payouts to people who have suffered severe life-altering brain damage from lead exposure, insurers usually send out monthly checks, often over the course of decades. In some places like Baltimore, these structured settlements have given rise to a large and effectively unregulated secondary market where companies purchase the rights to future payouts, often for dimes on the dollar. Terrence McCoy is a reporter for The Washington Post. His investigation is called How Companies Make Millions Off Lead Poison Poor Blacks, and we have a link to it on our show page. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
How severe is the lead paint problem in Baltimore?
Well, Baltimore has a rather notorious place in the history of lead paint poisoning in the United States. Obviously, an extremely old city, and there are just the streets are lined with buildings that had at one point been painted with lead paint. This has been an historic problem in the city of Baltimore. At one point, although many of these problems have ameliorated, at one point the city, according to advocates, was annually producing tens of thousands of lead poisoned children.
New York also had many buildings with lead paint, but we passed laws to get rid of it. Has Baltimore been dealing with it as well?
Yeah, Baltimore has been dealing with it as well. I mean, since the 1990s, it has taken great strides to cleanse many neighborhoods of lead paint. Just a few days ago, HUD actually dedicated $4 million more to Baltimore in light of the information that emerged out of the Freddie Gray protest that Freddie Gray himself had been poisoned with lead as a child.
And you write about him in your article. Do we know how many people in Baltimore have become cognitively disabled because of lead paint poisoning?
There's no clear estimate, because the problem with lead paint poisoning is the study of its repercussions on the mind remains an evolving science. For years, people were convinced that the body could withstand high levels of lead. In fact, the Roman Empire once used lead as a sweetener in drinks. So what that means now is that the people are realizing more and more the fact that lead has serious effects, even in smaller doses of it. So no one really has a quite clear idea of how many people are affected, because the metrics of what constitutes repercussions continue to change.
Isn't it especially a problem when the exposure to lead paint, or lead in general, occurs during childhood?
It's especially dangerous for children. For two reasons. One, children absorb lead paint or lead exposure at a higher rate than adults do. And number two, a sort of cruel irony of lead is what I just spoke about a moment ago, is that it's sweet. It can taste like candy. It's a poison candy for children, meaning that when there are lead paint chips all over the house, children sometimes find it irresistible to eat it.
And then how long after that do health problems arise? And what kinds of health problems do arise?
Well, the health problems that do arise are often increased impulsiveness, diminished capacity, difficulties reading, understanding, difficulties learning. And also there has been studies that have shown that people who are subjected to lead paint poisoning have higher levels of criminality. That's often linked to increased run-ins with the law, Freddie Gray being one of them. Obviously, it's always difficult to, in a lifetime of variables, to pinpoint exactly what is the causation of someone's actions, but these could be contributing factors.
Have there been a lot of lead paint lawsuits in Baltimore?
Baltimore has had thousands of lead paint lawsuits throughout the years. One attorney who I spoke to, he and his team have litigated more than 4,000 lead paint lawsuits, and a fraction of these lawsuits have resulted in what's called a structured settlement, which is different than traditional settlements. They are intended to protect vulnerable recipients, those who might not have any experience managing large sums of money, and they dispense in regularized schedules over decades so as to help that person ameliorate the stresses of their life, number one, and number two, so to prevent them from squandering it immediately.
What's the average payout?
It depends. It depends. From my research, I saw that on average a number of people probably were given maybe $500,000. Sometimes the settlements can go astronomically high. A couple settlements have settled for $9.3 million. There is legislation in Maryland that put places limits or caps on how much money people can get, but they can go quite high.
I'm speaking with Terrence McCoy, a reporter for The Washington Post. We're discussing his investigation, how companies make millions off lead poison poor blacks. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How did what you write about the secondary market for these settlements come to be?
Well, it came out of my research into Freddie Gray himself. During the course of the protests, I dug up his old lead paint lawsuit and was able to construct a narrative out of his life and his childhood from that.
And you say he's a case history in the effect of lead poisoning on poor blacks.
He's an example. He's the archetypal lead paint victim. The progression of where his life went, and also the deals that he struck. By 2013, both he and his siblings, after they received their structured settlement, were striking deals with a company to sell off large sums of money for a couple of those deals, what were pennies, not pennies, but dimes on the dollar.
How much did he sell the settlement for?
One deal, he sold off $146,000 around there, which had a present value, keep in mind, because he was selling it off that day, of about $94,000. And in return, he got about $18,000. So that's about 20 cents on the dollar there.
Aren't there many ads for companies looking to purchase structured settlements in Freddie Gray's neighborhood?
All over Baltimore, they play ads on the radio, on TV. People get ads in the mail. It's a pretty aggressive advertising campaign that a lot of companies push to try to find people with structured settlements. And then once you end up doing a structured settlement deal, your name is then logged into public record because the deal has to go through a court proceeding. And at that point, companies are able to find you much more easily.
Why has Baltimore, of all the major American cities, become a major hub for the secondary settlement purchasing market?
I think there's various factors, one being the high number of personal injury plaintiffs, whether it's a result of lead paint or other factors. Another one is the fact that the law in Maryland, according to experts, is substantially weaker than a lot of laws that govern how this industry is intended to operate. There are certain requisites and requirements that other states have passed that Maryland has not. So that might have something to do with the fact that there does seem to be a lot of deals here.
What were some of the cognitive issues that Freddie Gray had?
Freddie Gray was in special education, never graduated high school. Difficulties that you see across a lot of lead paint victims. Difficulties just learning. Difficulties. I believe he was taking classes to try to help him concentrate. That's a big issue with a lot of lead paint victims. It's just the inability to really concentrate on something, and that was evinced in Freddie Gray as well.
One company that participates in the secondary market is called Access Funding. How large is it?
Access Funding is not the biggest player in this industry, far from it. There are much larger players that work and do these deals. But what Access Funding does do is a high percentage of its deals revolve around some of the poorest neighborhoods in Baltimore, some of the most impoverished pockets of the city that are pervaded by the highest percentage of lead paint victims. And a large percentage of Access Funding's deals have dealt with those people.
You found that Access Funding often offers 33 cents on the dollar, and that altogether the company has purchased about $6.9 million in future payments to lead poisoned people for only $1.7 million. We're talking about fairly large returns here.
Yeah, we're talking about a fairly large return. The present value of those payments were, I think, about $5.3 million, and that was only representative of a 52-case sample that I selected randomly to try to get a bulk feeling of what how these deals are really moving and how they work, and that there is a large discrepancy in that. Of course, Access Funding and other companies say that the reason that they pay out less money is because various factors, like there's something called a life contingency clause in a lot of these deals, which means that if the person, the recipient, dies, those payments stop. So the company itself is taking on a risk as well, too, because if they pay out 20 grand and that person dies a year later, tragically, they would be out of money. So that's a big reason why they say, you know, sometimes the numbers aren't as balanced or as equal in that way.
Is that one of their selling points to people? If somebody dies, you're not going to get any more of the money. If you get this lump sum now, you'll get a lot?
I know that these companies do a lot of ways to be able to sell and be able to try to get clients to do business with them. The primary way that they do it is just the allure of fast cash and quick money. I mean, when you realize disability and poverty are very expensive things. There are bills, whether that's a medical bill or whether even trying to post bail for someone. There are emergencies that strike, and people need to get money somehow. And oftentimes that may mean leveraging what is their only asset. And when they're in that position, they're desperate, and at times people don't get that much money compared to how much they're giving up.
Is Access Funding pretty representative of the industry?
Access Funding has done a lot of deals in Maryland. The industry, obviously, because there are a few guidelines that really try to there's no regulation, like there's no oversight committee like FINRA or anything else that really looks at how this industry operates. So it's difficult to really say what's representative and what isn't, because sometimes there can be companies that kind of flash in the pan, and other times there are companies that are extremely reputable. So it does really run a gamut.
Now, we talked about ads that alert people to the possibility that they can get the full payment. But don't companies like Access Funding actually track people down looking into public records?
That is one of the ways that they do it. As we spoke about a moment ago, when you transfer or do one of these deals, it gets logged in the public record and it goes through courtrooms. And what that means is that companies are able to then search or troll these public records and sift out names of potential clients. And when that happens, it's fairly easy to find someone's contact information. And they just call them up and say, hey, I saw you did a deal. Are you interested in doing another?
And I wonder how many people turn them down. Do
that's
we have a sense?
That's difficult to say. That's difficult to say. I know a lot of people. I know the number of deals that end up getting signed and whoosh through the court system or go through the court system are smaller than the number of deals that people try to do. Whether that's because all of the money that person has is already gone and they don't have any more money to sell, or whether they're confused and maybe they don't even have a structured settlement, they have something else. But I do know that the number that ultimately they end up doing deals with are not as big as number of deals end up going through.
And are they doing deals with the people who are the victims of lead poisoning, people who have diminished capacity in most cases,
or
their families?
Well, it's what happens a lot of times is it's not just one person who is a victim of lead paint poisoning. The way that these lawsuits work is they're filed by a family. They're filed by three children or four children or two children who had lead paint poisoning. And oftentimes you see when you look at the court ledger, the court docket, it's not just one person from a family that ends up doing a deal with the company. It's multiple children in the family. So oftentimes the entire family can end up selling off whatever their compensation was from that original lead paint lawsuit.
Can a settlement be sold more than once?
No, you can sell off portions of it.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you sell off, maybe you say, I want to sell off this amount, or I want this much money. And then they take a portion of it and remain. And then one girl who I talked to, one young woman who I spoke to, was between the course of she was 18 and 19, 18 and 20, did four deals in which she sold off all of her structured settlement. So it's bit by bit by bit. And then she ended up falling into homelessness afterward.
Because you give somebody a lump sum, it's likely to disappear fairly early. If you give it to them in smaller increments, then they have something coming in next week. But on the other hand, I suspect some of these people feel, well, I have this big payment I have to come up with. I want to buy a house, or I'm in debt. I want to pay off my loans.
The logic that governs the original reasoning behind structured settlements is the same logic that comes back to haunt a lot of these lead paint victims, and the fact that they weren't originally even trusted or they were advised not to take a large settlement because the thought was, or a large lump sum, because the thought was that they would have difficulty managing it. So then what happens later is that they end up taking a lump sum anyhow, but that's significantly smaller than what they originally could have had. And the same precepts govern that as well, where that ends up being dissipated fairly quickly.
The woman that you wrote about named Rose said that she spoke with an attorney named Charles E. Smith, who was supposed to be her independent advisors. How were they introduced to each other?
Well, that is one of the ambiguities that Charles E. Smith says that Mary Alice Rose reached out to him. But this is something that lawmakers in Maryland are looking into right now, or say they're looking into. And the fact that how exactly, I know I looked through 52 of those deals with Access Funding, and in every single deal, Charles E. Smith was the independent professional advisor. And critics say, you know, that raises questions of whether or not there's a conflict of interest going on there.
Is there any evidence that he was working with or for Access Funding or one of the other companies?
That he's working with other companies. Charles E. Smith says that his participation in this industry represents a small percentage of what the totality of his business is, and that's what he says.
Did he ever meet with Rose in person or inquire about her mental faculties?
He spoke with Rose. I know that some deals or some of these conversations are done over the phone. Other independent advisors meet with people in person. Charles E. Smith, he filed a letter to the court saying that he spoke with Rose.
My guest is Terrence McCoy, who's a reporter for The Washington Post. He has written how companies make millions off lead poison poor blacks, and we have a link to it on our show page. We invite listeners to call in if they've had any experience along these lines with lead poisoning or with the kinds of deals that we are talking about here. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We'll take a little break. Be back with more right after this. And we are back with Terrence McCoy of The Washington Post. We're talking about his article, How Companies Make Millions Off Lead Poison Poor Blacks. And we, as I've said, have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. We also invite your calls if you want to join the conversation. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And Hugh has written in on Twitter. He asked, didn't paint manufacturers know for decades about the effects of lead in paint but covered up the reports?
Well, in 1978, Congress or federal authorities passed a series of regulations that pretty much more or less banned or got rid of lead paint in paint, because the science was just becoming too overwhelming, and it was just decided that this was something that couldn't be done. As to the role or the complicity or implicit, whether the manufacturers were implicit in that, I can't really speak to that or not. But I do know that this is something that has obviously been thought of to be a problem for decades, and federal bodies and state bodies have acted to ameliorate those damages.
Well, as far as the thing we're talking about, the buying of structured settlements. Didn't Maryland pass legislation about this issue 15 years ago?
Yeah, Maryland, along with other states, passed legislation. Baltimore also got active in it in the 1990s, and it's done. The city's taken great strides in being able to eliminate a lot of problems with lead paint poisoning and lead paint in the poorest communities. This was a what what critics would say a neglected problem for decades or years. But it is something that's not neglected anymore. But still, we see the remnants of what was once a lead paint endemic in the city.
But there are loopholes in the Structured Settlement Protection Act in Maryland. In New York or in the tri-state area here, we don't have these kinds of problems.
Well, in Maryland, there loopholes are the Maryland's law was passed in 2000, which was one of the first states across the nation to ink something called a Structured Settlement Protection Act, and it didn't have the requisites or prerequisites that later iterations of that same bill would carry. For instance, it doesn't require that. Companies file their petitions to purchase someone's structured settlement in the county in which that seller resides, meaning that sometimes sellers have difficulty possibly getting to the court hearing itself because it's far away from where they live, or they just aren't able to get there. And that, in some ways, it makes it more difficult for judges to be able to determine whether or not this deal would be in the best interest of that seller if they can't eyeball the person.
And doesn't it require the judge to sign off on these purchases by companies like Access Funding?
Exactly. Judges have to sign off on it. And it's something that the legislation that Maryland signed and many others signed as well more or less outsourced the responsibility to these judges. And this is where it's very important for the judiciary to be able to do what the law says they should be doing, which is they're given the discretion, the subjective discretion, to be able to balance or find some sort of balance, a delicate one oftentimes, between competing desires, one being these companies' desire for profit, another being the recipient's level of desperation or other vulnerabilities. And sometimes, this is a difficult area to ascertain and difficult area to walk, but it's up to the judiciary and those judges to be able to make those decisions.
You identified one Maryland judge who signs off on a number of these settlements. How often does he say no?
Well, I found I looked through about 160 160 of these deals that this company, Access Funding, filed through his courtroom, and roughly about 90% of them he approved. And I listened to a couple of the hearings themselves, and they were quite short, and they didn't take too long. Obviously, that we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I mean, it's entirely possible that the judge is really taking a scrutinous eye to all these affidavits that are being put before him. Unfortunately, the judge declined my request for comment.
And do we know whether these companies shop around for judges?
That's difficult to say. I know that critics say that that sort of situation in which they're not forced or required to file their petitions in which the county that the recipient lives has oftentimes given to something called forum shopping. And that's when companies can kind of shop around and look for what one person told me are the squeaky wheels, the places in which you can file a lot of petitions there, and they kind of glide through the process.
Is this all complicated by insurance companies fighting not to make these payments in the first place?
I think it's complicated on any number of levels, that being one of them. The fact is that insurance companies, this is good for structured settlements are good for insurance companies as well, because it allows them to sort of dissipate their burden over a series of years. And then also when you think about the decreased value of payments far off in the future as a result of inflation. So what happens is insurance companies are for it. Lawyers are for structured settlements because oftentimes it can protect vulnerable recipients, and Congress is for it and more or less makes these payments tax exempt. So it's good for the recipients as well because they don't have to pay as many taxes on it. So all in all, a lot of people are for these.
You spoke with a man named Scott Blumenfeld. He's another independent advisor who counseled sellers. How did he get involved in this industry?
Well, Blumenfeld is a person who got involved by doing started off working as a notary. A lot of these contracts are required to be notarized, so he'd work as a notary. And then he later took on another role in which he became one of these independent professional advisors who are vested with the responsibility of counseling advising the annuitants before the deals go through. And then finally, he took on another role, more or less working as a broker. And he's trying to, he says, make some room so people could get more money than they otherwise would have.
How does he feel about his work?
He feels that he is doing everything he can to try and get people more money. That's what he says.
Mm-hmm. Does he go drive around Baltimore looking for sellers?
No. I mean, when he was a notary, something that he would do was that he would be dispatched to people's houses, and he would go out to their houses afterward. And that's when he was traveling through some of Baltimore's poor neighborhoods.
Is he at all critical of the industry?
At this point, he calls it what he thinks to be a predatory industry. He thinks that some of these deals that people are striking, and also he's had to weigh the fact that some of the recipients are quite vulnerable, and trying to come to some sort of way to be able to, the deals are being struck with people who are vulnerable. So at this point, he does think of it as something of a predatory industry.
Now, you also interviewed a man named Vincent Maurice Jones Jr. How severe is his lead poisoning?
I spent some time with Vincent Maurice Jones Jr. At his house, and his house is it's very dark inside. Black curtains hang over the windows. There's detritus of the artifacts of poverty litter the living room amid a cookie tin that says Access Funding on it. And he's done a number of deals. He's a man who's young. He's 24 years old, never got a driver's license, aged out, he said, and was never able to graduate high school. His lead paint lawsuit is littered with examples of what would seem to be failures in the classroom and skipping grades, failed classes. And he's had a tough go of it.
Was he difficult to talk with because of his diminished capacity?
Yeah, he's someone who has difficulty maintaining a lengthy conversation from the experiences that I had with him. He asking him questions would be difficult for him really to answer them. He's someone who, according to the interactions I had with him, would kind of meander in what he was doing, would flit in and out of the room, or he just kind of focus on a video game.
How well does he manage out in the world? Could he get a job?
His lawyers at the time, when he filed that lead lawsuit, and psychologists thought he could not, and he does not have a job right now. And he's living with his mother with a house that he purchased with funds from one of these structured settlement deals. And every time I saw him, he remained in pajamas.
You reviewed his affidavit, the one that he signed, which was written by Access Funding. Were there any red flags in it for you?
There were some red flags, one of it being the fact that it spoke of his daughter when, in fact, he has a son. Another being when he spoke about wanting to get a car, which tells me he did buy a car, but he doesn't have a driver's license. And a third being that he spoke of wanting to stop paying rent, despite the fact that he had just bought a house and was no longer paying rent. So those were some peculiarities involving those affidavits. It's difficult to ascertain what exactly happened. I mean, anything could really happen in those situations.
He relinquished $327,000 worth of future payments for just $16,000. Did you talk to Access Funding about that, ask them how they could do something like that with somebody like Vincent Maurice Jones Jr.?
Well, he relinquished the present value of that structured settlement, I believe, was about $160,000, $170,000, somewhere around there, for about, $17,000. And the reaction is that these are people who Access Funding says has real needs and have interests and need of capital, need of money. And oftentimes people like that, they say this is the only way that they can leverage and get those sort of assets, that sort of money. So they strike these deals.
How did all the people you spoke with who'd sold their settlements feel about the deals now?
I spoke to nine people or eight people who had done these sort of deals, and only one person said that they still felt okay with it. She said that the deal helped her stay out of homelessness and helped her keep her home. despite the fact that she regretted it. The other people said that, you know, there was a mistake, and other people used words like scam or the fact that they didn't quite know what was going on. And they regretted it. I mean, that's a lot of money to lose for not that much in return.
There's already been some fallout from your article. What are Maryland lawmakers talking about doing?
Well, I spoke to a couple Maryland lawmakers yesterday, and they are at this point trying to craft some sort of legislation that would tighten restrictions on this industry. As we spoke about before, the Maryland Structured Settlement Protection Act is has some weaknesses, experts say, compared to other places. So they're trying to strengthen that legislation. At the same time, the Attorney General, Brian A. Frosch, says that he's interested in looking into these transactions, and also Representative Baltimore's representative in the Congress, U.S. Congress, said that he has sent a letter to Access Funding at this point requesting certain information and documents from them.
Has there been any community activism in Baltimore around this?
It's one of those things that when I would travel around Baltimore and talk to people, it's something that everybody knew about, everyone talked about, everyone knew about what they call lead kids or lead checks or these sort of companies, because everyone's so familiar with these advertisements. But as far as community activism goes, I'm not sure there's that much, considering that oftentimes people are embarrassed by what happened. They're embarrassed, or they don't want people to know that they even had the money in the first place. A lot of lawyers counsel their plaintiffs or their clients not to tell anyone that they got this money. Because when you tell people that you have that money, especially in communities like these, everyone's going to come out of the woodwork and try to hit you up for something.
The headline of your article, How Companies Make Millions Off Lead Poison for Blacks, suggests that you're saying that these people are being preyed upon.
Well, I think the article is representative of the fact of when you just compare the dollar amounts, how much money people make versus how much money they give up. I do know that the people who do these lead paint victims oftentimes have diminished capacity and diminished ability to be able to understand these contracts. And whether or not that's up to the companies to determine the people that they're doing these deals with, that's up to the readers to decide. That's up for the lawmakers to decide. But the fact is, when you put these things out on the table, you have people who have diminished capacity, and you have large sums of money that are going out and significantly smaller amounts of money that are coming in.
Terrence McCoy is a reporter for The Washington Post. His investigation is called How Companies Make Millions Off Lead-Poisoned Poor Blacks. Terrence, thank you so much for talking with us on our show today.
Thanks.